in one way, it's very easy to introduce Professor Hayek. We all know him. We all admire him. And when we learned that he had been given the Nobel Prize in Economics, it gladdened our hearts. That's what makes it easy. On the other hand, there are difficult aspects to this task. One is supposed to give a brief survey of the contributions of a speaker. Well, one was going to discuss the contributions of Professor Hayek. One couldn't be brief. Nor is it easy for any ordinary mortal to deal with them. For besides his contributions to economics, which have been in many areas, Professor Hayek has also made important contributions to philosophy, to psychology, to history, and to law. Well, no one could deal with a person of such gifts except someone like Professor Hayek. And there's only one Professor Hayek. So I will not even attempt to make such a survey. However, what I would like to do is to talk just a little bit about something that I do know about Professor Hayek, and that is his influence at the London School of Economics. I remember hearing in, I think it was 1931, a series of public lectures on prices and production, which Professor Hayek gave. They were, in my time at the London School of Economics, the most successful series of public lectures ever given. Then later on, when I had the good fortune to join the faculty of the London School of Economics, I had Professor Hayek as a colleague. And I was there able to observe the decisive influence which he had in that flowering of economic theory which took place at the London School of Economics in the 1930s. An institution which still showed traces of the teaching of Edwin Cannon would not be wholly bad. But it has to be confessed that in those days, that is, when Professor Hayek first arrived, there was a certain wooliness to our thought. What Professor Hayek did, by example and by teaching, was to introduce rigor and precision into our economic analysis. And so one sees his influence in the works of others, even in the early days, in people who've since strayed a little bit, like Nicky Keldor. Now, he had this important contribution to economic theory and to the way in which it developed at the London School of Economics. Professor Hayek was also important in straightening out our views on economic policy. And, of course, the work which really set the seal on this endeavor was the book he published at the end of World War II, The Road to Serfdom. In that work, Professor Hayek threw a burning light which cleared the mists which shrouded the road on which we were going and showed us what our destination was likely to be if we continue. I sometimes wish he hadn't done this. For in the 30 years which have elapsed since he wrote his book, we've continued on the same road, which means we're a little nearer the destination. Professor Hayek is an old friend of the Philadelphia Society. He has addressed it on two previous occasions. Once he presented a paper on competition as a discovery procedure. This was done in 1938. I had the good fortune of hearing these views in the 1930s, and very important they were in the development of my own thought. Professor Hayek also spoke at the Western meeting, at a Western meeting of the Philadelphia Society, and today we're going to hear him once again at the National meeting. The world knows Professor Hayek as a Nobel laureate in economics. To us, he has a greater claim to fame. He is the champion of liberty.
To which I have just referred, you might perhaps allow me just to tell that story, how it happened to me for the first time in this country to have to address an audience without any idea what I was going to say in the first or in the following sentences. It was at the beginning of the lecture tour I was brought over to give in 1945, as a result of the publication of The Road to Serfdom. My publishers, the University of Chicago Press, had arranged for me to give a series of three lectures successively at five different universities, lectures which I had carefully written out for the occasion. And I came over in slow convoy, war was still on, expecting to visit these five academic institutions and sedately do what I had learned to do, give academic lectures to academic audiences. Well, I was incommunicado, in convoy, for 13 days. And arriving in Norfolk, Virginia, I was met by a highly excited person that I was late, that the University of Chicago Press, as a result of my book having appeared in condensed form as a Reader's Digest, had given up the job of organizing my tour, had handed it all over to the Concerts and Artists Organization of the United States, and then I was to go on a popular lecture tour all over the United States. I was rushed to New York and received there on the evening with the information that the next morning I would have to address Town Hall, New York. When I asked on what subject, I was told on the rule of law in international affairs, a subject which I had never given the slightest thought. I was frightfully embarrassed because somehow the word Town Hall suggested to me something which perhaps the older ones among you will still remember, this delightful little group of American women which a certain Miss Huckinson used to draw for the New Yorker, to whom you seemed regularly to talk, who were designed to receive visiting foreigners. Well, the next morning, I think it was scheduled that they'd have 11:30 in the morning, I was picked up at my hotel, and in the car I asked, well, what is Town Hall, New York? What sort of audience had you expecting, say, 20, 30? The answer was, Hall holds 3,000, but there's an overflow meeting by wireless. I still had no idea what to say. I was getting a little dizzy about it all. I was ushered in that I should say that I never, literally never, done any popular speaking before, had been confining myself to academic audiences. And when I was ushered in this enormous hall, I think the last thing I do remember is that as I was rising, the chair whispered in my ear, it must be exactly 45 minutes. So I stood there, knowing that I was scheduled to speak on the rule of law in international affairs, without having the slightest idea of how to be. All I knew is that I had two alternatives, either to talk myself into great excitement or to collapse at once. So I managed to begin with a tone of profound conviction that I was going to tell my audience, I didn't know what. But I did finish a sentence somehow and got going and got to a successful lecture, which I gradually, in the course of the next 6 weeks, when I was all over the United States, I developed into something which I believe made sense. Now, that was the manner in which I was introduced into public speaking, or at least in which I learned by chance a manner of public speaking, which to my great surprise seemed to go down well, at least with Americans who evidently liked this kind of spontaneity, which I would never have trusted myself to assume voluntarily, but which I was thrown into. Now that leads me, in fact, to my real story about which I want to talk today, the origin of the Mont Pelerin Society. This lecture tour was the first, but the most extensive series of visits to places where I was talking about the subject of the road to serfdom, and almost every place, first in the United States, and then various places on the European continent where I was invited in the following summer and autumn, there was usually one isolated person saying, no, I have held your views for years. But I thought it was the only person on earth I held it. I've never talked to another libertarian like you. And who really was the one contact I had. Now that led me to the idea that after all, if there were such isolated people that nobody could talk to, all spread through the world, it might be nice to bring them together on some occasion. And for the next year or two, I used to go around talking about how nice it would be to establish such an organization. But of course, impractical as I was, not dreaming of actually putting, or even imagining that I could do it. And then another curious accident helped me. As in the course of my travels, speaking visits, I went to Switzerland. I found there a very curious situation, which is now known to all my European friends, that there, Röpke, unfortunately, late Professor Röpke, had established a somewhat similar reputation, worked on similar lines, and extremely able and successful organizer, Dr. Hunold, had raised funds to enable Röpke to start publishing a journal. But before they could do so, they had quarreled. And so there were the funds and Hunold on one side, and Röpke had capacity and ability to run it on the other side. Well, Röpke had lost intention of doing so, but when I met Hunold, he said, look, I've got this money, which is given for support of our cause, and I would like to devote it to organizing such a conference if Röpke could agree. So my first task was reconciling Hunold and Röpke in order that the money which they were entitled to use was turned over to organizing the first meeting of the American Society. Now by that time, my ambition, or rather my conception of the aims of the society, had expanded a little. It was no longer merely a question of providing a discussion club of people with common views, but I had realized in the course of my discussion that we really had a great deal to learn of each other, that in talking to people who were competent on a particular subject, but with whom you shared a common basic philosophy, you could learn an enormous amount. And secondly, that this must not be confined to economics proper, because the problems of a free society, although there are very large economic problems, but by no means only or chiefly problems of economics. Well, the first meeting of that group, which became the Mont Pelerin Society, was already devoted to the two tasks of providing a platform for interchange of opinion among scholars and publishers, sharing a certain basic philosophy, but having expert knowledge in different fields. And it was always intended, very much more than the Mont Pelerin Society actually became, to be a link between at least economics, law, political science, social philosophy, and perhaps certain aspects of history. In fact, the first meeting, the first little group of 37 from Metro Mont Pelerin, were a much more mixed group in this sense than the society ultimately became. And we made one discovery very soon. In trying to get a membership for the society after it had been constituted, we were looking around for people who shared basically libertarian conviction and found they were practically all economists. There were hardly anybody but economists who still believed in the basic principles of freedom. Our sincere and genuine desire to make it an interdepartmental group founded on the fact that non-etatist, non-socialist, political scientists or social philosophers and so on were practically not to be found. Wherever we looked for some people, we found out they were economists and nothing else. And so much to my regret, the Mont Pelerin Society became a society predominantly composed of economics, and as a result, inevitably devoting its discussions very largely to subjects, more or less of not exclusively, of technical economics. Now, I have increasingly regretted this because that initial awareness of the close interconnection of the different problems which I had already achieved in writing The Road to Serfdom, and similar books became stronger and stronger as time went on. Economics is frightfully important, but economics is not enough to create a decent society. I myself have devoted a great deal of my time since to the relation of economics to law and political science. And I have since regarded developments going on here in Chicago, very largely the work for inspired by Ronald Coase here on my left and the Journal of Law and Economics, as one of the most promising developments in this field. But I believe we must carry it even further. At the present moment, I have reached a stage where I am convinced that there is a built-in trend towards government dominance in the existing political institutions. And that even if the majority of the citizens were economically well-informed and were basically in support of a free market society, the trend away from it would consist. Because we have succeeded in building up, under the name of democracy, a sort of political system in which a politician or a government, even if it has the best of intentions, cannot avoid satisfying the demand of special groups and special interests. We are inclined to blame the politicians, but the fact is we have placed our politicians in a position where they can do not much different from what they do. If you make the government in idea or in conception omnipotent, the government cannot say anything to no to anything if the public knows the government can do it. The only thing, way of preventing government from doing harm is to make it impossible to do certain things, to limit the powers of government. Now the great misfortune of history, as I have now seen it, has been that the carefully designed checks on the powers of government, which constitutions were intended to be, the restrictions designed and hedged about the old monarchies were deemed to be unnecessary once the power was transferred from monarchs to the democracy. Now it was thought there was no need to limit government any other form except by it having to obey the power of the majority. What was not understood at the time is that under the existing kind of democracy, what we call the will of the majority is by no means a true agreement among a majority, but are conglomerates built up by governments bribing a sufficient number of groups to support them. And if you have to bribe groups in order to obtain support, you have to take constantly special measures in favor of particular groups. Now that means that the ultimate hope for returning or preserving a free society, I'm not sure which phrase I ought to use now. I used to speak about preserving a free society, but I'm no longer quite sure that it's still appropriate. I think we must already speak about the return to a free society. The ultimate hope of returning to a free society must rest on the chance that we can fundamentally revise our political institution. I think the first need for this is a very deep understanding that the institutions which now exist are not the only necessary form, the only possible form of democracy, that there are other types of democracy conceivable. Because a great many people believe they must defend the existing institutions because they identify them as a democratic principle and would free themselves from betraying a high ideal if they criticize the existing institutions. Well, I think one of the first things we'll have to make clear is that there are other forms of democracy conceivable. That is very large a historical accident that democracy has produced an omnipotent representative body which we call the legislature as if it were confined to making laws in the old sense, which in fact is an omnipotent power which can issue any orders it likes, which knows no limitations whatever, but we've really reached the stage where it is no longer true that the legislator is called legislator because it makes laws, but where we call laws whatever is made by the legislature, which normally is mainly a governmental agency. But it's really on these points that we must direct our attention for the future. I think it's very important that we should do so. Because I must confess, one of the things which really worries me, contrary to my reputation, is the increasing dissatisfaction and malaise about the institution of democracy. More and more respectable and decent people I know are throwing up their belief in democracy, believe democracy has failed, and resign themselves to the inevitability that it will disappear. I think that is based on an error. I think it is fully justified if you identify democracy with a form of government, with what I've called an omnipotent legislature. But it's by no means necessarily true of the basic idea of democracy, under which both the making of laws and the conduct of current affairs is in the hands of representations of the majority, but not in the hands of one and the same representative assembly, who can at any time make the laws which it needs to achieve the particular ends it wants for the purpose. I think in that direction that we have to think about alternative forms of constitution which might achieve what the great theorists of representative democracy of the 18th century hoped to achieve, but our existing institutions certainly have failed to achieve. Thank you.